The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
The FT.
If you're one of the tens of thousands of investors who hold funds managed by Neil Woodford, what should you do as he announces his departure from Invesco Perpetual? Ministers say no one should have to sell their house to fund social care, but can we really believe them? And the lessons to be learned from the Earl of Cardigan's unsavoury spat with his own trustees. I'm Jonathan Ely, and I'll be giving you all the money news this week in downloadable form with the help of my FT colleagues, Joe Cumbo.
Hello.
Lucy Warwick-Ching.
Hello.
And our special studio guest, Darius McDermott, Managing Director at Chelsea Financial Services.
Hello.
We start with the shock news that Neil Woodford is to leave Invesco Perpetual next April to set up his own fund management venture. Neil is without doubt the top dog among UK fund managers. The funds he manages have over £33 billion in them. That's over a third of the entire equity income sector. His flagship fund, the Invesco Perpetual High Income, has turned £1,000 into more than £22,000 since he took the helm in 1988. Invesco has said that his responsibilities will be divided up among the existing team. Mark Barnett, who manages the UK Strategic Income Fund, will take over the High Income and Income Funds next April. However, that has not been sufficient to ease worries among some about the departure of such a high-profile manager. Many advisers have taken the funds off their select lists or reviewed their recommendations. The share price of the Edinburgh Investment Trust, another product in the Woodford stable, has dropped around 10% since the news was announced, and even shares in Invesco, which trade in the US, have dropped in response. I'm joined now by Darius McDermott, who researches funds and is Managing Director of Chelsea Financial Services. Darius, generally speaking, when top fund managers leave, investors' money has a tendency to follow them. Is that what you expect to happen in this case, even though Neil isn't actually leaving until next April and we still don't really know what he's going to do next?
I mean, Neil Woodford is, as you say, the top dog in the UK fund management arena and has made a lot of money for investors. He's also extremely well known and very popular. So I would think there will be a large flow of money from existing Invesco products to his new enterprise as and when it comes.
Okay, but you don't necessarily envisage that starting today or tomorrow or
I think
money going to other funds in advance of him leaving.
Yeah, most people have taken a sort of wait and see. Mark Barnett is an extremely experienced fund manager and has worked with Neil for 17 years. So I think there's no initial need for people to panic. There are a number of other good equity income funds that people have been inquiring about, but there's not been as many phone calls as one might have anticipated in the last couple of days.
Okay. Now, Invesco is pledging continuity with the new managers. You mentioned there that Mark Barnett is himself very... very experienced manager. If you look at the top 10 holdings of the two funds, they're very, very similar. But a big part of Neil's style was these big macro bets, these big sort of choices. I'm not going to be in tech stocks in 1999, or I'm staying out of banks in 2007. Is a new manager going to be able to replicate those really bold, high conviction calls?
I mean, it's going to be extremely difficult. I suppose you might suggest that he's had as good a training as any because he sat next to Neil Woodford and worked alongside him for such a long period of time. And whilst they do have a lot of overlap in stocks, the actual portfolio construction is slightly different. For instance, Neil owns 9% of Astra and Mark owns 3.5%. So it's, you know, quite different slants, but they do have a big stock overlap. On the macro side, you know, I think it's incredibly difficult to judge today whether Mark is going to be able to replicate that. What we do know is that Mark is a good fund manager in his own right, but he has sat alongside Neil Woodford and some of that, those macro calls clearly have, you know, worked their way into his funds as well. So it's going to be tough, but I think if anybody's got a chance, somebody who's at least worked with Neil for such a long period of time has got as good a chance as any.
You mentioned there that there are some other useful alternatives if you're looking for a sort of a defensive fund or a UK equity income fund. What are those if you weren't prepared to stick around until April next year and you wanted to move your money out now?
Yeah, the sort of the obvious go-to fund, I think, in this particular circumstance is the Artemis Income Fund. It's the second biggest fund outside of Neil's products and run by the extremely experienced Adrian Frost and Adrian Gosden. They do have a similar style, and you know, that fund has performed very well over time. We also like Threadneedle UK Equity Alpha Income. It's a slightly more concentrated version, again with an experienced fund manager in Lee Harrison, and those are sort of our two favoured sort of large cap funds. There are plenty of other good income funds that do different things. There are a raft of products done very well in the last 5 years that invest in smaller company income stocks. And funds that have exposure to that type of theme, things like Rathbone Income is a multi-cap income fund, and Standard Life Equity Unconstrained Income Fund is also a multi-cap income fund that people might want to consider for some diversification.
Okay. And finally, do you have any insight into why Neil Woodford left Invesco, or indeed what he's planning to do next? He himself, of course, is remaining very tight-lipped until next April about that.
I mean, I think it's probably the million-dollar question as to why. He has been there a very long time, has been very successful. I think the attraction of potentially running his own business as well as running a fund appears to be something that may have come into consideration. I also think he probably would be looking forward to running a slightly smaller pot of money again, as whilst I'm sure he will get substantial support. 33 billion has taken him 25 years to build up, and it's such a huge sum of money. So I think we'll see a broad equity fund from Neil, and it's always going to have an income tilt because he does like companies that generate cash and can grow their dividends over time. So I think we'll get a broad income fund, whether or not it actually goes into the income sector, I think it's a question which we wait for the answer, but definitely a broad UK fund is what we would expect.
Thank you very much, Darius. That was Darius McDermott of Chelsea Financial Services. There's plenty more on Life After Woodford in this weekend's FT Money, which you can also read on Kindle, tablets and online at ft.com/money. Still to come on the show, why a row over assets held in trust shows how important trustees can be. But first, let's take a look at the vexed issue of social care. I say vexed because the government is tying itself up in knots by trying to make promises that it knows deep down it can ill afford to keep. The promise in this case is that no one should have to sell their home to fund long-term care. In late 2012, as part of a big review of funding social care, ministers said that all local authorities must offer a deferred payment scheme. That's where the council effectively pays for some of your very expensive social care and then recoups that money from the sale of your house after you've died. At present, provision of this facility varies widely from one authority to another. However, buried in a consultation paper this week is a proposal that access to the deferred payment scheme should be subject to a means test. The Labour peer, Lord Lipsey, has said this renders it virtually useless because it means applicants will have to exhaust practically every other resource available to them before they can access the scheme. It also makes the whole system still more confusing. Research conducted by FT Money and Saga earlier this year showed that there was already widespread confusion over who pays for what when a person requires long-term social care. I'm joined now by Joe Cumbo, who commissioned that research and has been looking at this week's events. Joe, how would the proposed means test on deferred payment work?
I don't agree that it's going to pull the rug out of from this whole scheme, but it certainly is going to make it more complex. What will happen from 2015 under what was described as 2 years ago, is that when you need to go into care, into residential care, instead of having to scrap around or thinking about having to sell the family home, which can be quite an emotional decision, you could go to the local authority who would offer you access to this scheme. Now, currently, as you mentioned, it's quite patchy. Not all local authorities will offer that. But under this new requirement from 2015, all local authorities will be required to offer this scheme. But what we've seen and we've discovered this week and it's emerged is that it's going to be restricted to individuals who have got less than £23,000 in assets. So what this will mean, instead of going there as soon as you need to go into a home, you've got to think about how, you know, your savings and assets, the level of them. So it could take you longer before you can access that scheme.
Right, and you'll have to exhaust, or you'll have to spend all your ISA money and all your...
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Now, when it comes to paying for social care and the state stepping in to pay for it, aren't there already multiple caps and tests and thresholds on the amounts that the government will pay?
This is making the scheme even more complex. I mean, the whole purpose of the reforms, the government said, was to make it more simple for us to plan for our care costs and to give us peace of mind that we won't need to sell our homes to fund those care costs. But it certainly is very difficult to see how adding more restrictions into the scheme is going to meet those two principles that they want to achieve. As you mentioned, that there are caps and means testing that already exists within the system. And from 2016, under the reforms, we will see the introduction of a new cap of £72,000 on what individuals are expected to pay towards their costs in their lifetime. But there will be also a new means tested threshold of £118,000, above which you won't get any help, below which you can get some help from the local authority to pay for your care costs. So you can just see from the mentioning of those two figures there that the system is still quite complex.
Mm-hmm. And that's only from 2016, of course. Can you remind us how the system works, if that's the right word, from now until then?
Very few people will get access to any help from their local authority to pay those care costs, because currently the limit in England, the means tested limit, is about £23,000, and that includes the family home. If you've got a home, your total assets are more than that. You'll have to self-fund and pay your way, and that's where you get into the situation of people looking to fire sell the family home to pay for those care costs. From 2016, that threshold is going to rise to £118,000. So if individuals have got assets including the family home, that's almost four times the current means tested level, they will have to pay their own way, but below that they can start to get some state help. But the second peg of the reforms is that you're going to have to pay £72,000 at a minimum
before the state
will step in.
Okay. Now, you mentioned there that for many people, selling a house, a family home, is a very emotive issue. It's clearly also a very political issue, and the government seems very hung up on this idea that having to do it is a scandal. But there is another strand of opinion, isn't there, that sort of says, well, how else are we supposed to fund social care? It is very expensive, and why shouldn't people sell their houses to do so? How's that debate likely to be resolved?
Well, at the moment, housing is such a big issue for a lot of people, and they're relying on it to pay not just their care costs, but also pensions. We don't have a lot of systems in place yet to get people funded for their old age. So people are still relying on property to pay for a lot of their costs in later life, and I don't think they're quite ready to let go of that. What the government is trying to do with this proposal is to release the sort of need to make fire sales or decisions or emotional decisions to sell a property. But you're right to mention that there is a lot of debate about whether the state can continue to pay for the costs of elderly, for people going into care, and people say that perhaps we should take more responsibility and think about selling our homes to pay for those care costs, and we can't expect to pass on those assets to our children, for example. That shouldn't be, it's part of a mindset in this country, but perhaps we need to rethink that. But currently there are no other ways to save ahead specifically or prepare for those costs, because there aren't any insurance products. So either you save with cash or your investments to make money, and it can amount to tens of thousands of pounds. So what happens is that in that vacuum, people are just relying on their property.
Okay, thank you very much, Jo. This is an issue I'm sure we will hear a lot more about in future. You can read more about it this weekend too. There are more details of the social care bill in this weekend's FT Money. If you want to leave comments, many people have strong views about this very emotive subject, you can do so online, or you can email us. The address, again, is money@ft.com. On to our final item for today. Since the start of this year, the Earl of Cardigan has been in the headlines rather more often than he might have liked. He's been accused variously of spitting in someone's face, cutting off an elderly man's water supply, vandalising cars and wrecking pheasant feeders. He says he is living in just one room on his sprawling 4,500-acre estate in Wiltshire and claiming job seekers' allowance. The cause of all this is a protracted and bitter dispute with two trustees of his estate, whom he appointed in 2005 when he went to live in America. He says they are selling off family assets without his consent and denying him access to his own money. And he is not alone. Bust-ups between settlers who establish trusts, the trustees who run them, and the beneficiaries on whose behalf the assets are shielded have been on the rise lately. More and more wills are now being contested. Lucy Warwick-Ching has been investigating. Lucy, perhaps we could start by explaining what exactly a trust is and how it works.
Well, trusts have been around for a very, very long time. They were kind of first seen in the Middle Ages when knights were kind of leaving home to fight and they just wanted to make sure that their assets were protected. So in case they died, they wanted to make sure, say, their property and wealth would be passed on to their children. Essentially, what they're used for is to transfer assets. So you need to, if you want to set one up, you have to talk to a trustee and transfer the assets to the trustee, and then the trustee actually has the responsibility of paying out those assets to certain beneficiaries.
Aren't these vehicles just for the aristocracy, really? I mean, you talk about knights there, and the mere mention of the word estate conjures up sort of images of stately homes and acres of land.
Traditionally, yes. And yes, they are more commonly used by very wealthy individuals. But I think as people's family situations have changed, they are becoming more common. So if, say, two people are coming together and they've got children from different marriages, then they might consider setting up trusts so that it's just so that assets can be shared out fairly. The reason lots of lawyers and advisors say that their clients like trusts are because they can sort out some of the complexity with people's finances. So it means that if you are worried about what's going to happen to your finances once you die, you can get it all drawn up and hopefully be able to then pay out your estate to exactly who you want to and in the way you want it to be paid.
OK, so if you're thinking about setting up a trust and you need to appoint trustees, what qualities should you be looking for? I should point out that, of course, you have to appoint trustees. You can't just set up a trust and run it yourself.
Yes, exactly. But I think traditionally some people were just asking, relatives, family, friends, you know, what's called lay trustees to look after their assets. And now people are more commonly getting kind of professional trustees. So what you need to really be looking out for is somebody, you know, it may sound a bit obvious, but you want someone who's trustworthy, someone with experience of financial affairs, someone that's not going to get confused or concerned if they're drawn into any kind of family battles. You want somebody you want somebody who's actually going to outlive you. You know, it may sound obvious, but you don't want to entrust it to somebody that's, you know, in your peer group, because you could then find that actually they might get ill and die before you.
OK, now you mentioned lay trustees there, and many people do say, well, of course, you shouldn't mix business and friendship. One of Earl Cardigan's trustees was, of course, a friend and presumably isn't one anymore. Is it actually wise to appoint personal friends, or are you better off going to, say, a lawyer or an accountant and asking them to be a trustee professionally, even though it will probably, I assume, cost you money to have their services?
I think from speaking to people this week for writing this article, lawyers and advisors are kind of saying you need a bit of a mixture, really, because problems do arise when you have family members looking after estates. One lawyer I spoke to this morning was saying he's dealing with a case now of an uncle that was entrusted some money for his niece. And he has actually now spent that money. I mean, I think he's saying that he was borrowing the money of the estate and always planned to pay it back, but the money is now gone. So even if you do sue that person, you're trying to get the money back. I mean, it's just when you introduce those extra elements of, you know, people, you know, who aren't necessarily financial advisors and don't really know exactly what they're doing. And the other thing is, if you have a family member or a relative who's dealing with the estate, then they can get caught in the middle. If there's some of these, but two people that they know very well are contesting how this money should be spent, then they may find themselves, you know, paralysed in the middle, just not really knowing what to do with that money, not wanting to upset anybody, and then probably not really doing the best thing probably for the financial assets in that trust.
OK, thank you very much, Lucy. There's more on that story in this weekend's FT Money and probably in the tabloids for the next 3 months. Don't forget, FT Money is available on Sunday as well as Saturday and all the time at ft.com/money. Other highlights this week: as a new chair of the Federal Reserve is named and the US government standoff ends, we look at what the end of QE might mean for asset markets. John Redwood updates on his low-cost ETF portfolio. We have some more on how banks are getting ever choosier over who they lend to. And there's more too on the disgraceful saga of Catalyst Investment Group, which was fined last week for selling unsuitable products to retail investors. That's it for this week, but in the meantime, don't forget that you can read money articles all week on our website, ft.com/money, where you'll also find blog posts, readers' comments, and a whole range of useful calculators and tools. But until then, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Joe, Lucy, and our special studio guest, Darius McDermott.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.